And first, we're going to talk about the investiture controversy. The investiture controversy. And as you know, last week we were talking about the rise of the papacy and continuing to grow in its power. And here you have a controversy over the power of the Pope and actually a relation between powers that different people had. And investiture, that word on its own, would be given someone something that signifies that they have an office. So giving them a ring or a symbol or whatever that signifies that they have the power of that office. And the controversy here, the investiture controversy, was over who has the authority to appoint people to these positions. Who has the authority to appoint bishops to the cardinalate? Is it the Pope or is it the emperor? And you can see there was a power struggle going on there. That was the struggle of what the investiture controversy was all about. And so different people had different feelings about how the power of the Pope would balance with the power of the emperor and vice versa. And there were three general theories on this. The first one was that the Pope and the emperor both kind of had their own realms, their own dominions in which they would exercise their authority. They were both commissioned by God for authority in their certain realms. And so they both had their power in these different realms, both commissioned by God for that. The second theory behind how they interrelated in their thoughts was that the emperor actually is superior to the Pope in secular affairs, but the Pope has his reign in the spiritual affairs. So you got secular affairs, temporal stuff, temporal ruler. You're dealing with spiritual stuff, eternal stuff, that type of weight, and spiritual ruler. The Pope is the authority there. But then the third mindset that some people had was that the temporal power, or the emperor, was subordinate not only in temporal matters, but also in spiritual matters. So that it was really the Pope who had the power even in the spiritual matters. Those are three ideas going on, and controversy was over that during this time. And we'll go through this reform movement here that's letter B, and then we'll see how this continues to kind of be a controversy and a developing feud between them. And that is the Cluniac reform movement. And what brought this on is that there were declining morals in the church, declining morality in the church. And so there was a movement of people who wanted to reform the church, to root out immorality, to keep it pure. And this was the Cluniac reform movement. And it started in the year 910 in Cluny, which is in eastern France, And what they were trying to do was to liberate the church from control by the secular. So free the church from secular control. They were trying to abolish simony, and he wanted to pay some apostles to get some power. So simony is when you pay a fee to get you a position, a high position within the church. And there were people doing that. They were paying money so that they could have high positions within the church. And this reform movement wanted to root that out and abolish that. So simony is when someone is paying to get a holy office, paying to get an office in the church, or trafficking money that is in the spiritual realm or in the religious realm. So this reform movement wanted to root that out, abolish it. They also wanted to enforce celibacy among the bishops and all the religious leaders, because there was immorality in them, and they thought that by enforcing celibacy, then that would clear up the immorality problem. So that's why they attempted to enforce that. And then also, they wanted to elevate the Pope's office, the papacy, as the real governing power in the church, to elevate the Pope, the power of the Pope, elevate his power. And then these aims of this reform movement, these reforms, were enforced by Henry III, and he was emperor, and what you could write down about him, something to note about him, was he put three popes in a row in, and the last one was Leo IX. Leo IX is a key one to remember that's related to this reform. Leo IX. And there are a few things to remember about him. And the first one is that he reformed the cardinalate, so all the bishops, to include a more diverse group. It wasn't just Roman representatives, and that made people happy. Also, he was involved in the division of the church, or the schism. You see the year there, 1054. And also, he was important because he brought Hildebrand on, and the name is up on the board. Hildebrand appointed him to the cardinalate as a bishop, and Hildebrand is important for who he was because later on he would be Pope Gregory VII. Secular control. Yep, liberate the church from secular control. All right, so Hildebrand was brought on by Leo IX as a bishop, and this is important because, number one, under Hildebrand and his contributions, he was the power behind the throne. The power behind the throne. For 25 years or maybe 30 years before his election to being pope, he actually was the power behind everything. He was a shrewd manipulator. He was the one making things happen. And everyone knew that the real power lied in his hands, in Hildebrand's hands. And so even before he was pope, the power was really in his hands. He became pope, and as you know, the popes take on a name when they become pope, and so he was Gregory VII. He became Pope Gregory VII in 1073, and he was one of the greatest popes, and by greatest that means the most powerful. He was one of the most powerful popes, and some of the things that are key to remember about him that contributed toward this power that he had as pope, his view of the church. He would say the Roman Catholic Church, founded by God alone, the Pope's universal, Pope doesn't make any errors, the Pope has the authority to dispose emperors when he wants to, it's all in the Pope's hands. So, a supremacist view of his power and the power of the Church. So, he would say the true ruler of the world is the Pope, and that he would claim that he had the true power over the world as Pope Gregory VII. Some of his early reforms, first he reformed the College of Cardinals, so all the bishops, which was a continuance of what Leo was doing, picked right up on that. He also abolished simony, so he did no longer allow people to buy good offices within the church, so he abolished simony. So many of those reforms just continued to happen. And in the investiture controversy, this continued to push the envelope because you could see the growing power behind the papacy and how he was asserting his power as pope. And so this came into a struggle that he had with Henry IV. And they were waging a battle for control. Henry IV was Holy Roman Emperor, so emperor versus pope here. They just had a power struggle amongst them. Henry IV actually wrote some things, said some things that he didn't really regard Gregory as pope anymore. And Gregory wrote back to Germany. He said, find a new king. And the Germans didn't like the lords back there in Germany. They didn't like Henry too much. So they said to him, you need to bow to the pope. So they told him to bow to the pope. The feudal lords were upset with him, so they forced him to bow to the pope. So you see the struggle continuing on there between pope and emperor, investiture controversy, where's the real power, the authority of power overall. And this kind of was coming to a head, in a sense it did, at the Concordat of Worms, or Worms, right, on the Rhine. And this was a place where they talked this out, and they say they worked a compromise. Actually, it wasn't too much of a compromise. They didn't solve too much of anything. But they decided that spiritual power was going to reside with the pope and the bishops and all that, and temporal power was going to be given to the kings, emperors, and all that. So they decided spiritual things to the pope, temporal things to the kings. And this was a compromise, and this was going to solve it all. What we see is it didn't really cause a lot of good. It increased division among people. It may have caused some political good and expansion of boundaries and territories. I don't know a whole lot of details related to that, but they do say that it may have caused some political good, but really in the end didn't solve much of anything and truly wasn't that great of a thing that there was a compromise in this. And as we're going to see through the rest of our discussion today, a lot of things flowed from that. This was in 1122. A lot of things flowed from that that were kind of messy. So Concordat of Worms is their compromise in the investiture controversy. So you could say in a sense that the controversy ended, but truly there continued to be issues going on. So we'll continue on with that. It was Henry V that was emperor at that time. So you saw 3rd, 4th, and 5th there. We move on to the Crusades. The Crusades. What were the Crusades? Holy Wars. And their objective was that they were going to go to Palestine, go to the Holy Land, and reclaim it from who? The Muslims. They were going to take it back from the Muslims. So these were military campaigns. They were under Christian leaders. And they're going to take back the Holy Land from Muslims. They're going to rescue these sacred places. They were under the banner of the cross doing all this. And that's what the Crusades were. There are many elements that contributed to that. And I'll list some, but can you think of any things that you think may have led to why they wanted to do this? Just from your knowledge of things past?
The Muslims had taken over a lot of the land around there, and Christianity pretty much died out.
Yeah, so the Muslims had is one of the reasons. It's somewhere down there. I listed it as danger there, I think number 5. Danger, so the Muslims were kind of pressing in from the east also, and they wanted to drive them back, and they had the Holy Land in the first place. So that would be one of the reasons. Anyone think of any other reasons? I'll just go through some. The first one's adventure. There's always someone who wanted adventure, and there were a lot of people who were involved for an adventure, silly as it is. But there were a lot of people who were in there for adventure. The second one's riches, or the appeal of riches. Word got around that there were riches in the East that were greater than that in the West. So a lot of people said, I'm going to go off and get rich from this. And so some people did that. Also, in the East, there were relics. Palestine was a place to get relics, items from the history of the church. And later on, we'll find that some people would get some and worship them. So they were esteemed of high value in many people's minds. 4 is merit. And a lot of people thought that it would merit them something special to their faith if they were to go to sacred places, holy places, and worship there. There are a lot of people who still think that today. And I think
spiritual advancement.
What's that?
That idea for spiritual advancement.
Yeah, that it would merit them something spiritually. I think in the year 2000, the Pope designated certain places that people could go within the Catholic Church that it would merit them something special. So there, you know, in religion, there are still things like this, that if you go to somewhere and do something, you will get special measures of grace or whatever in your life. We mentioned 5, which is danger. And then 6 is readiness. There were some people who were going around preaching that the second coming of Christ was soon. Peter the Hermit, who was a hermit, he talked about how the coming of Christ is near. They needed to make Palestine ready. So there are many factors that contributed to this. You could continue to list things, but those are a number of things that do. We're just going to survey through the Crusades, and I know that some people have divided it up that there's 8 or that there's 9 or whatever, but we're just, that's not our focus tonight. We're just going to survey through what happened through these years. And so the first one was the end of the 11th century, and this was called for by Urban II. He was Pope Urban II, and there was 600,000 people, and they marched, but strangely they weren't really under one good leader, so there were just hordes of people everywhere, and it was kind of chaos, but they marched, and several hundred thousand of them died on the way. But by July of 1099, they got to Jerusalem, and they said, we've got enough people that we could take Jerusalem, and so they took Jerusalem, and they slaughtered Muslims pretty bloodily in their slaughter there in Jerusalem. That was 1099. As I go through these, you can list however many details you want to list. You don't have to put everything. It's up to you. But that's what happened in the First Crusade. And then after that crusade, if memory serves me right, they divided it up governmentally into four type of states. And then what happened is one of those fell again to Muslims, and so that precipitated the next round. So in the Second Crusade, this one was called for by Bernard of Clairvaux, who was not an emperor, not a pope. You see his name on the board there. And actually, Bernard of Clairvaux, we sing his songs in church. Did you know that? O sacred head, now wounded. Jesus, the very thought of thee. He wrote some songs that got translated, and we sing that are in our hymn books today. But he called for this crusade. There were 1.2 million crusaders, possibly, and they tried a preemptive siege of Damascus, but it failed. And the reason why it failed, after it failed, Bernard said to the people, it was because of your sin. It was because of the way that you treated the Jews. They did not treat them kindly in the land. And so he said, that is why this went down, is because of our mistreatment of the Jewish population. So that's why he said that it failed to these people who failed in this siege of Damascus. The third one might be the most famous, also called the King's Crusade or the King's War. And you might know some of these names that were involved in it. What led to it is the Sultan of Egypt had united the Arabs and the Turks in the east, and so there was a crusade against them, and Philip II was involved. He was from France, and Barbarossa, Frederick I, was involved, and he was a Holy Roman Emperor, and then also a guy from England, Richard, the Lionheart. Richard the Lionheart. And he was involved in this, and so this was called the King's Crusade, many people call it. They gained a lot of victories along the way, defeated Muslims at various points. They even got within sight of Jerusalem, and they probably could have taken Jerusalem, but Richard said that he thought he did not have enough people to hold Jerusalem after they took Jerusalem, so they stopped. And that was how that crusade went. Richard actually was on a ship on his way back. It got wrecked. He got taken into captivity and then handed over in captivity later on after that. So that's the tale of Richard. And then his brother, of course, was John, whose rival was Robin Hood. Yeah. Russell Crowe. Yes, Robin Hood. So that's Richard the Lionhearted, the Third Crusade. The Fourth Crusade was initiated by Pope Innocent III. Pope Innocent III, and the Crusaders attacked Constantinople, and they established an empire there, the Latin Empire, which was an attempt to have an empire in the east to complement the Holy Roman Empire, as I understand it. But it didn't stand that long. It only stood for 60 years, and it didn't have any strength. So that was the fourth. The fifth, 1217, the Crusaders took a place in Egypt, and they thought they could take Cairo as well. They attacked Cairo, but they ran out of supplies in 1221. So it was kind of a foolish attack at Cairo in 1221. And then Frederick II, the sixth one, he led the Sixth Crusade. And he tried to conquer Egypt, failed, so he brokered a treaty with the Egyptians, and it gave many Christians places of power within Jerusalem. So he got a good number of Christians into some positions in Jerusalem. And how do you think the Muslims liked that? They didn't. So that led to a Muslim siege to take it back and get them out of there. So then there was more unrest. The Seventh Crusade, Louis the Ninth of France organized it. He was a failure. He was taken captive. Not much detail there. The Eighth, France paid the ransom for him to be released. So he led this. They wanted to go to Syria to remnants of people who were there, but they got diverted, and Louis got sick and died. And the Ninth Crusade, Prince Edward of England, before he became king, attempted to pick up where this had all left off, but there was just no more spirit in the people. Surprising, huh? Right. So that is the Ninth Crusade and kind of the end of Crusades. Another note would be the Children's Crusade, and there's debate whether the details of this were as has been taught for a lot of years. Don't really know, but the story, one of the stories goes that a 12-year-old boy named Stephen saw a vision that he was going to lead children into the Holy Land, and so the legend goes that they did that, and there were 30,000 children who marched under the lead of a 12-year-old boy named Stephen. And none of them got there. A lot of them died. And the rest were sold into slavery. And that was the Children's Crusade, 1212. Other accounts might say that it was poor and marginalized people and not children. We don't really know. But that's the Crusades and the Children's Crusade. So the popes and the Crusades, how were the popes involved? How did they respond to them? Did they urge them on, that type of thing, and the church actually too? Number one, the popes encouraged the Crusades. We noted that many of them initiated some of these. They encouraged the Crusades, and there were a lot of good things in it for the popes and for the church. What the pope did is the popes would make a lot of promises, and the popes promised remission of sins for the people who would go on these crusades and were involved in them. And they promised that if you died, you'd go to heaven. They made these promises. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. So those were promises made. And another thing you could put under number two is that the church became wealthy because many of these people, when they went, they said, if I go and I die, the church can have my whole estate. They can have my land. They can have my wealth. So it is said that the church may have owned a third of all of the real estate in England. That's a staggering amount of real estate. So you see the promises there that were made by both sides and the involvement of the popes in the Crusades. There were effects of the Crusades, of course. You think they were a success? What was their goal? Take back the land. How'd they do? They didn't. So the number three there, the overall effect, in the end, they were a total failure in view of their goal. They were a total failure in view of their goal. You could say that there were good and bad things that happened along the way. Some bad things were that, some bad effects were that it deepened the hatred that Muslims had toward Christianity, continued unrest between Muslims and Christians. Deepen the hatred of Jews toward Christianity. Unrest there. There was just general intolerance among all groups. Many people did grab relics and start worshiping them. So it led to relic worship, which would be a bad effect. Some say there were good effects because on one hand it did extend the power and the influence of the Pope and the power of the church at that time. The Roman Catholic Church, so that to them would be a good effect, is that it gave him more power. Some say that it gave people a bigger view of things. Intellectual life was stimulated, and that the world was just different for them and that that was for the better. But in the end, when you look at it in light of their goal, total failure, the Crusades were. So that was the Crusades, the attempts to take back the Holy Land from the Muslims. We'll go on to the monastic orders. And monastic, of course, means pertaining to monks. Monks. So we're going to talk all about monks. The monastic orders. And just some general observations. First, many considered being a monk was the highest call of God. They thought this is the highest call of God to be a monk and to be able to worship Him, commune with Him, or in however way that they did that, and to be poor and ask for things and suffer like they did. They were the right arm of the papacy. As their numbers grew, the power that the popes had also grew. So they were his army in that sense. And number three, they furnished missionaries and reformers and saints and popes within the church. So they were helpful to the life of the Roman Catholic Church and just symbiotic for it, helped it on. We're going to look at a few different orders of monastic orders. So different types of monks. They fell into different teachings, different emphases within these orders. And the first is the Franciscan order, and the founder of that was Francis of Assisi, and his name's on the board here. And he was from central Italy, where Assisi was, and he lived from the 1100s into the 1200s, would be about when he lived. Some Catholics honor him as the greatest of all saints. He was born wealthy, but one day he encountered a leper and befriended him and took great sympathy on him, and that caused him to have a real heart for the poor as he went through the rest of his life. And that was a changing moment in his life. And so when he went to the scriptures, he always emphasized how he saw in Christ the poverty that Christ was in, and how that was, he said, it was the prime fact of Christ's life. So he wanted to live like that. He wanted to live in poverty like Christ lived, because that was the essence of Christianity to him. Also, under the Franciscan order number two, the order became strong missionary organization for the church, especially so toward the Muslims. Francis himself went to Egypt and to Syria. So Francis went to these places. And three, there are still people today who call themselves Franciscans. You won't see too many specific reference or teaching, something gleaned from St. Francis of Assisi that is specifically still enacted today, but there are still people who call themselves Franciscans. So he never changed his practices, but their practices are different than his word back then. Another order would be the Dominican order. Dominican order, and this was founded by, and when you look at the name Dominican, you can see it right there, Dominic. He was a contemporary of Francis of Assisi, so they lived at the same time. But he was the opposite of him. Instead of being simple and gentle, he was a fighter. He was willing to lead a fight, and he wanted to lead fights against heresy. That's who he was. He wanted to fight heresy. And so the purposes of this order, first they wanted to preach the doctrines of Rome. They wanted to preach the doctrines of Rome and teach them the doctrines of the church. They wanted to do mission work, and they wanted to fight heresy, especially that of the Albigenses, who we will look at later. So they especially wanted to fight heresy in the Albigenses. But they lacked the warm personal element of the Franciscan order. So they were different in that aspect. These two orders, we're going to look at some characteristics of them. They were not total seclusion, total silence orders. They lived within a community. They were out among the people. They depended on the people of that community for their well-being, livelihood, continuing on. So they were in amongst the people, working as monks in that regard. All right, so characteristics of both orders. They were mendicant orders. M-E-N-D-I-C-A-N-T. Anyone know what mendicant means? It means you're a beggar. So they were beggars. And they lived off donations from people. And they were mendicant, they were beggars. They called themselves brothers, or what's another word for brother that they would have used? That we would term them now, friars. Yep. The French word is frère, and the Latin is frater. We have the word fraternity, which is a group of brothers. So they called themselves friars or brothers. They were directly under the authority of the Pope. The Pope was their authority. But as long as they kept obedience to the Pope, they were given great freedom within their realm of influence. And most did that. So they had great freedom within their groups, within their orders. They were right under the authority of the Pope. They promoted education in general, and soon they were looked to as key figures within education. And their lines of thought, their teachings became the ones that everyone looked to and regarded within dialogue and within conversational circles. So they were looked to highly for their teachings, and they promoted education themselves. And they began to restore preaching to places, to services. That was one of their things, because they were there to teach and to look at the doctrine of the church, the Roman Catholic Church. And so they propagated that, and they began to restore preaching in services. There were some other orders that are listed there. The Carthusians, they were in France, and they were ones who kept silent. They were ones who were in silence. I know there is a story, and I should have looked it up, of a guy who went up and sat on top of a pole of some sort, probably this big around or something, for 37 years or something like that, and kept silent for 37 years and sat on top of this pole. And I should have looked that up tonight and said it, because I think he was Carthusian, but I shouldn't. I'm being taped, so I probably shouldn't say this without knowing it. Also, the Cistercians is how you say that one. And Bernard of Clairvaux was a Cistercian. Cistercian. Cistercian monk.
What did they do? They lived in a
cistern. What's that?
They lived in a
cistern. They lived in a cistern. Cistercians. No. I don't have much on them. But we'll talk about Bernard again in a moment, and that'll contribute to that. So, Bernard of Clairvaux was a Cistercian monk. Three, the Premonstrants. They were French, and they were almost wiped out in the Revolution, the French Revolution. And there were other orders, smaller ones that I didn't list here. There was an Augustinian order, which developed in the 13th century, which Martin Luther was an Augustinian monk for a time, and there were other orders as well. But those are the key ones that we've looked at, and we'll continue on with that. A couple of these names will pop back up, Bernard of Clairvaux, in a minute, when we talk about mysticism. Mysticism, when I say that word, try to describe it. What comes to mind? What would you say if I said so-and-so is a mystic?
Spiritual experience.
They emphasize experience. They emphasize inward looking to understand how to commune with God. They're looking for this connecting link between their soul and God, and they find it when they look internally. So they would have emphasized emotion rather than reason. They would have emphasized contemplation. They would have emphasized visions, intuition. They would have said, these are the avenues by which you approach God. They would think of the priests and the church as an avenue, but, or as an aid, but not as a main way, not a necessary way to get to God. Mystic religion was a matter of the heart and feeling. And they wanted to be lost in God. Why did mysticism get popular? Why did it get a rise or a following at this time period? What do you think? It was easy, right? Well, they looked at the church and they saw it as cold, formal, institutional, stiff. And so it was a reaction. It was a reaction against the church that was there. And that's a lesson of history also. We see that all the time. Movements that are reaction to something. So this is no different than that. Right in the vein of that. So it was a reaction against stiff institutional church. Bernard of Clairvaux was, in one sense, a mystic. We mentioned him earlier. He was a leader of a monastery at the Clairvaux Monastery, which was a Cistercian monastery. And his thinking dominated the world in the 12th century. He was the key guy. He was the one they looked to for all, for teaching, and he would have been one of the religious leaders of the day. Francis of Assisi would be another. He was another monastic mystic. He's a mystic monk. John Eckhart was German. He taught that every man has a divine spark in them, and that if you kindle that spark, if you cultivate that spark, that's how you find God. We've seen some philosophies through the years that teach that. So he was teaching that at that time. John Tauler was German as well. He was known for his sympathy, and he was also known for his sermons, and even Luther regarded him highly for his sermons. So his sermons were looked to by people. He was known for his sympathy and his sermons. And the Brethren of Common Life, they had an educational emphasis. So they were the ones that were teaching others about mysticism.
So they still believed in Christianity, though.
They believed in a form of Christianity, yes. So these are within the Roman Catholic Church, people who are emphasizing this approach to finding God was divine spark in them or, you know, intuition within themselves. Yes, in the name of Christianity. Yeah.
These were all operating within the established Roman Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and some of them were monks, as we saw. So, yeah. Yep. Next, we're going to look at Scholasticism, and you kind of see how there was what they regarded as the mystics regarded as a cold, stiff, formal, institutional church, so they reacted against that. Here we have Scholasticism, and just here in the term, you kind of know what that's about. Scholasticism was an emphasis on the teaching of the church relied on schools that were attached to the cathedral schools is what they would term it as. This was kind of a shift away from monasticism, but also kind of a development within monasticism that went toward schools attached to the cathedrals. They wanted to rationalize theology. Like anything, movements did not stay static. They were developing things within them. Now they wanted to rationalize theology. We'll see some of the causes of it. So this is a shift away from monasticism, or you could say a shift in. I'm not really sure. You could say it either way. Some causes were, you can just write, the rise of Aristotelian philosophy. So just write Aristotle. There was a revival of his philosophical teachings. It had been revived pretty much around the world, and so the schoolmen, that's what the leaders of Scholasticism were called, the schoolmen. Schoolmen. They taught that, well, we'll just test everything by Aristotelian philosophy, we'll see everything through that lens, and that's how we will rationalize our thoughts on everything, our approach to faith, our approach to reason, how they relate, certainty of truth, all that stuff. So there was a shift within the mendicant orders as well, the monks, the beggar monks, and they became interested in this, and they were using this as their means of study. What were their sources? First one there is the Bible. They interpreted it allegorically, but the Bible was a source. to the creeds of the ecumenical councils, and they treated those with the same authority as the Bible. They said that these had the same level of importance as Scripture, the creeds did, and then also the writings of the church fathers. And they looked at many of them and used them as a way to prove that truth was reasonable, or they voiced ways that they disagreed with them. Both were going on there. Key figures within scholasticism, first one's Anselm, and he was called the father of the schoolmen. If you write down nothing else for him, just write down father of the schoolmen. He was from Italy, but he came to England, 11th century, to be Archbishop of Canterbury, which is head of the Church of England now. He was a realist. His principle was good. His principle was, I believe so that I may understand. He was trying to relate faith to reason. We'll see in Abelard, the next one, he was the opposite. So we'll continue to just look here. But Anselm and Abelard, both of them, these two key figures, there has been somewhat of, not a revival of their thought, but a revival of looking at some of their works, because what is kind of a hot thing right now in evangelicalism is a debate over the nature of the atonement, which is to say a debate over when Christ died, what did his death accomplish? And both of these first two guys listed here, Anselm and Abelard, wrote big works that were foundational at their time to views on what Christ's death accomplished. Did, when Christ died, did he die to satisfy God's wrath? Did he die just to show us how to love? Was he just an example? Did he die to pay a ransom to Satan? Did he die, did he take our sin in our place on the cross as our substitute? That's the debate. Now, Anselm wrote a book called Cur Deus Homo, which is why the incarnation, why the God-man, and he said it was to satisfy God's wrath. So there's been a revival of looking at some of his writings. So I've read some of his firsthand, not related to to scholasticism, but these guys are not back on the scene in their teachings, but looking at them at least. Peter Abelard's the second one, and he was known for his sharp mind. He was a bright mind, but he rubbed people the wrong way, kind of an abrasive guy. But he had a large following, and he was pretty influential, and he was opposite of Anselm in his trying to talk about how there could be certainty, how reason and faith go together in an apologetic sense. So his apologetic would have been different than Anselm's, and we won't go into detail on it, but we'll just say that. He wrote about the atonement, the benefits of Christ's death, and he said that Christ died just to influence us to do the right thing. It was just an example in that sense to show us what God's love was all about. That was his take on that. Lombard's the third one. He was called the master of sentences, which means he was the master of doctrinal statements, is what they meant by that. And so he wrote books. He had most of his impact through his writings, and books that he wrote were the standard in his day of doctrine. You can see the years on him. He was 12th century. And then we won't even get to say much about Aquinas, but Thomas Aquinas, he was a Dominican monk, and he established Roman Catholic doctrine as we know it today. His most important work was called Summa Theologica, and it was his magnum opus of his theology, developing theology in that book and teaching it to the Roman Catholic Church. So he was the foremost thinker in their circles in that day, and his writings have had a long-lasting impact on the church. You can see he died only at age 48. He died young. So, effects of the schoolmen, they accelerated the development of dogma. That is to say that they studied, then they wrote the sum of their studies, and it became the accepted doctrine within the Roman Catholic Church. That's what that means, basically, is what I'm trying to say there. They promoted education, and they organized and systematized and restated and all that stuff. They just organized all of theological teaching within the Roman Catholic Church. Systematic theology, we would term it today in our sense. So that's what they did. Now, the pinnacle of power, and we'll finish with this, Innocent III, who we mentioned earlier under the Crusades, he was the guy who brought the papacy to the pinnacle of its power, to the height of its power. The conditions were ideal for him. They had great wealth. They were getting all that land, you know, in the Crusades. They had all kinds of wealth, all kinds of power. The Crusades were a thing that all the people at that time were all interested in. So he had the power of the Crusades behind him, even though in the end they ended up failing. But for him, politically at that time, height of power. He says there he used the principle ratione peccati. That means reason of sin. And that is if a king or emperor, whatever, a temporal ruler, would make a decision, political decision, but it was morally wrong, he had the power to hold them responsible. He exercised the power that held them responsible. So he exercised that power. He held kings responsible for their decisions that were moral, immoral. He did this against another guy we mentioned earlier, Robin Hood's rival, John. And we'll also mention that in a second here. Three, he exercised the interdict, I-N-T-E-R-D-I-C-T. And this, does anyone know what that means? Have you ever heard of excommunication? Excommunication refers to cutting off an individual. Interdict was to cut off from the church an entire nation. So he exercised this power, excommunicated an entire area, and he did this to England because John, Robin Hood's rival, did not accept Innocent's nomination for Archbishop of Canterbury. So he interdicted England for 5 years. So he exercised, even if you don't come away with all these specifics, just come away with, he exercised all kinds of power as Pope, more so than anyone else did. That's the key that we're trying to say here. Four, he brought the German church under papal control. The German church. He promoted needed reforms in the church. The areas that the people told him that needed reform and that he recognized needed reform, he did. And by that, I'm not saying that he cleared up doctrinal error from our perspective. Okay, that is, there were things politically or for the well-being of the church in their perspective and in that situation and time, those are the things that he righted. All right, so that's what that means by he promoted reforms. And he called the Fourth Lateran Council in 1215. And at that council, it recognized the world supremacy of the Pope. So here we really have the pinnacle of his power. Sanctioned his reforms. Defined the doctrine of, here's a long word, transubstantiation. And what's that? Right. The Lord's Supper, they would have a cup of blood and a piece of body. Instead of a cup of juice and a piece of cracker, it literally was the body and blood of Christ. It's transubstantiation, Catholic view. All right, D, made toleration of heresy grounds for capital punishment. Not just heresy. Notice that. Toleration of heresy. So it was a step up in that. And then also made provision for the Inquisition to fight heresy, and we end with Inquisition, Papal Inquisition. And the Inquisition was a church tribunal, and their objective was to find heresy and root it out, get rid of heresy, and this is heresy from the Pope's perspective. So in a sense, it's what he didn't want or like. That's what's going on here. It's an authorized department of the Church, authorized by the Pope. In development, in the beginning, it was the bishop's job to deal with heresy. So it was the bishop's job to root out the things that the Pope wouldn't like. But as the Church grew in its power, it became necessary that there had to be someone else to do it. So there was a new body of bishops. Became official in 1229. Within bishops, they were doing this. And rationale, the Catholic Church viewed itself as the sole place of salvation, remember? And so they saw heresy as a cancer, have to root out this cancer. And so that's why they were doing it, which we've mentioned. Targets. And the first major target was the Albigenses, or the Cathari. And even them, we would recognize as heretics. They were Gnostic in their influences. They were Gnostic. They were from southern France. Cathari there means pure ones. So they called themselves the pure ones. They hated the Roman Catholic Church. They hated the Roman Catholic Church doctrine. In the 12th century, there were 4 million of them. And in the 14th century, guess how many of them there were? Zero. 12th century, 4 million. 14th century, no trace of them. So they were slaughtered by the thousands. The Waldenses, and they were named for Peter Waldo of Lyon, France. And they were the biblical sect of the Middle Ages. They were the Biblicists. If we say that we're the Biblicists today, they were the ones saying they were the Biblicists then. And the Pope excommunicated them in the 12th century. They became martyrs. They wanted to preach. They wanted to preach. They still exist. There are still Waldenses in Italy, but they're completely liberal. They're no longer Biblicists, the Biblicists of the day. Effects of this Inquisition. It destroyed or killed many evangelical Christians, many true Christians. It brutalized society. They'd been insensitive to suffering and to life. And so you couldn't trust the person next to you. Because this was happening within churches. It was maybe the person sitting next to you in the pew that someone was being buddy-buddy to you, but really they were rooting you out as heretic, and next thing you knew, you were gone. So that it brutalized society. Couldn't trust anyone because of that. Stimulated dissent from people against the Church, the Roman Catholic Church. So this was a good thing. People looked at this and said, how could this even remotely possibly be Christian? You know? What's going on, what they say they're doing it in the name of. So we see that there was dissent then against the Catholic Church for this, which was a good thing. And then it also scattered persecuted Christians throughout Europe. That's a good thing, right? The salt spread, if you think of it that way. So the true Christians, under persecution, scattered and perhaps the salt spread through that. Finally, it was a factor that led to something that came in the centuries that followed, the Reformation. It was a strong factor leading to the Reformation. So there you have the Roman Catholic Church and the Pope at the height of its power and what was going on